Erev Tov, everybody. Turn off your cell phones, please. This is one of my favorite programs we do at Torah Motion is our series on influential thinkers, great thinkers. We've really, over the number of years, we've done a couple of fascinating people. Often people are not so famous, but are very important. And it's been a pleasure, Dr. Lakshin. I think this is at least your third time giving a talk in the series. It's always a pleasure to have you. Being a longtime professor at York, he's written much on Parshanut. He is the spiritual leader of the Toronto Partnership Minyan, a friend of ours, and it's really a pleasure on behalf of Torah Motion to welcome him, to have him. Just before we start, I'll make a program announcement. I'm sure many of you noticed the Canadian dollar dropped below 80 cents. I don't know who's planning any trips to America, but if anybody's planning any trips to Europe on the Torah in Motion journeys, what we're going to do is we're going to accept up to $2,000 at par. Basically, that's a $500 savings on any of our trips. That's actually a little bit more than we can afford, but we want to be nice to people who are Canadians, and we know that it's hard to the Canadian, the dollar going down. So I really do want to mention that these are wonderful trips. Anyone who wants to come will take up to 2,000 American dollars on any of the trips at par, as long as the Canadian dollar doesn't drop another 10 cents or so. But anyways, okay, without further ado, Rav W. C. Hoffman, who's really a very important and fascinating figure, and Vakasha Harav Lakshin.
A pleasure to be here, and because my wife is here tonight, I don't have any choice. I have to ask people to introduce themselves, because I know at least half of the names of the people here, but not every name here. So can we go just Marty Lakshin.
Stanley Evers.
Michael Orr.
Thank you all for coming, and I hope we'll have an interesting time this evening. Mostly I want to talk about Rabbi David Zvi Hoffman's role as a Torah commentator and as a critic of biblical criticism. But maybe the first thing that I'd like to say about him is that, like most of the great Bible commentators in the Jewish tradition, I think Rabbi Hoffman dealt with Bible as a sideline. And mostly, he was a rabbi and a Talmudist and a halachist, and he wrote very important she'elot and tshuvot. He was a great leader of German Jewry. He was born in Hungary in 1865 in Viterbo, but that part of Hungary had a kind of German flavor to it. It was part of the Austrian Empire back then. Today it's actually his birthplace is part of Slovakia. As far as I can tell, most of his Torah knowledge was acquired at his time in the Pressburg Yeshiva, which was an extremely important yeshiva back in those days. He studied in many other places, but I think that he really became a great Talmid Chacham from his time that he spent in the Pressburg Yeshiva. He also studied with some of the, and had close relationships with some of the leaders of German Jewry, like Rabbi Israel Hildesheimer. And one of his first jobs was teaching at a school that was headed by Rabbi Samson Rafael Hirsch, who you heard about here if you came to the Torah Motion program about him just a few weeks ago. In 1873, Rabbi Hildesheimer founded the Rabbinical Seminary in Berlin, and he hired Hoffman to teach there. And after Hildesheimer died, Hoffman became the head of school of this seminary for the rest of his life. As I said, he was a great Talmid Chacham who had extremely deep knowledge of Jewish texts and also cared quite a bit about modernity. Instead of trying to describe his values, I thought one of the ways of understanding the values of Rabbi Hoffman was to read through a tshuva, an answer that he gave to a fascinating halachic question that is still asked in many synagogues today. So on the first page of the handout here, you have the question that Rabbi Hoffman was asked. She'ila. Baminyan shalanu yesh achad o shnayim shemechalalim Shabbat befarhesya. In our shul, somebody turned to him, he doesn't have signatures on the she'ilot that come to him, as many rabbis do put the signatures, but he has them there without the without their signatures. We don't know precisely where this came from, but it could have come from pretty well any shul in Europe. We'll see from the continuation that it didn't come from America. Although certainly it could have come from America. In our shul, there are a few people who publicly desecrate the Shabbat. Lo levad bimlachtam, not just for work. You know, in some circles, there was understanding. This phenomenon, my father, Zichron Oli Vercha, used to tell me about this phenomenon that existed here in Toronto and in many places of people who were extremely serious in their commitment to religious Judaism, but just decided that if they wanted to have bread on the table, they had to work on Shabbat. And they used to work on Shabbat because you would get, there were all sorts of stories about people who would take a job and they would have the job for 5 days, and then on Friday they would say, I'm not coming, and then they'd get fired after being employed for one week. Sort of many people who were serious about their commitment to Torah Judaism and actually worked on Shabbat because they didn't see an alternative. But said, no, that's not what we're talking about here. Lo levad bimlachtam, ki im gam osim mugmar. Anybody know what this phrase means?
Smoking.
Smoking. Very good. Yes. Rabbi Turin said, so mugmar actually in the Talmud is something that's used like incense to make the house smell good. But I don't think that that's the reference. Rabbi Turin must be right here. It's a reference that they smoke on Shabbat. So somebody who smokes on Shabbat is different from somebody who works on Shabbat because they don't have an alternative. Vafilu kiddush vahavdala inam osim. People who come to shul, so shul, that there are people who go there who work on Shabbos and who smoke on Shabbos and don't make kiddush and don't make havdala, isharu letzorfam leminyan. Are you allowed to count them for a minyan? Where you're counting heads, do they count as part of the 10 that is necessary for making a minyan? As I said, this is a question that comes up in many circles. I would say that in any shul that I know of here in Canada, no one goes around asking questions like this. But in the halakhic literature, it's a serious issue. And Rabbi Hoffman, first of all, goes through the literature that's been written on the subject. I shortened his discussion of it in point number two here. Tshuva ha-pri megadim siman nun hei be'eshel Avraham siman katan dal katav di b'chalel Shabbat b'farhesya ein mitzarfim leminyan. The great halachic authority, the pri megadim, wrote that you can't count somebody like this for a minyan. V'chein katuv b'tshuvat chacham tzvi, another great rabbi in the generations before him, siman lamed chet. V'chatav ha-magen Avraham siman kuf tzaditet siman katan bed mishu hu rasha befarhesya ein mezamnim alav. You can't even count for a zimun for a rabotayin of arech at the end, before Birkat HaMazon. If you've got three people who ate bread together and one of them doesn't keep Shabbos, you can't count a person like that for zimun. So he goes through the text, and the text seem pretty clear, as he says. Any sin, any public sin, very good. That, you know, that it's even more than this, and it's not just for a minyan, it's even for zimun, and you might have less of a problem with zimun. Hayotze mikol hanal. She'al pi din, number three here. For the result of this, I shortened the survey of halachic literature, but in his survey of halachic literature, he says, Hayotze mikol hanal she'al pi din, mechalel Shabbat befarhesya, ein mitztaref leminyan. It's clear, the law is, you can't count a Jew who desecrates Shabbat for a minyan. And now, the next line is, I think, my favorite kal vachomer in all of rabbinic literature. Rabbi Hoffman writes, Ach bazman hazeh noagim lahakel. But these days, people are lenient about this question. Af be'eretz Ungarn, even in Hungary. Umikol shekein be'eretz Ashkenaz. You're asking a German rabbi, and I know that in Hungary they're makel on this. So what kind of question? So we're dealing with someone who has immense Torah knowledge, and takes this very seriously. He's also got a sense of humor. You're trying to get a German rabbi to say that you shouldn't count somebody like this in a minyan, when we know that in Hungary they count this. So what kind of question is this? But now he's going to tell a funny story that happened in Berlin. Uschurani, I remember one time, shepam achat erai velut leisha achat shechanuto patuach b'Shabbat. One time, somebody who keeps his store open on Shabbat lost a parent and was coming to shul to say Kaddish, this Mechalel Shabbat. V'hu achad mi balabatim shel kilateinu. He's a member of our shul who works on Shabbat, and he's saying Kaddish for a parent. Kahal adat Yisrael. V'yarad lifnei hateva b'beit haknesset shel kilateinu. And he said, okay, I'd like to daven mincha. I'm the Avel, I'm saying Kaddish, and he led the service. Achagabai yada leratzot oto ulefaiso shelo yered od mipnei shakahal yiranenu alseh. So we felt a little funny about this. So the gabai, who was a very smart man, went to him and said that, I don't know if it's such a good idea for you to be the shaliach tzibur here. And he didn't say it because you are a Mechalel Shabbat and we don't allow it. We just said, do you really want people talking about you? You know, it's like for your benefit, I'm suggesting that maybe you would prefer not to be the Shaliach Tzibur, because I hear people talking about this, that this guy is the Shaliach Tzibur and his store is open on Shabbat. V'achar kach halach zeh ha'ish lebed ha'kneset shel chevre shas. So he went to the Frumer Shul down the street, to Chevre Shas. V'af shahagabai desham haya ish chared v'yirei Elokim, hinichol yired lifnei hateva b'li minia. And even though there's, you know, there's a charedi place there, that other shul, the gabai there didn't have any objection to him being shalich tzibur at that shul. V'chasher sha'alti, this is number five, v'chasher sha'alti at the gabai lama lo mena'o, amar li shekeinu gam kein minhag miyamim kadmonim bebeit ha-midrash depo. She'in monim milered lifnei ha'teva ha'anashim she'mischaram patuach b'Shabbat. V'kevan sha'rabanim d'sham sha'yu anshei shem lo michu mistama hayata amam v'nimukam imam. He said, we've been doing this for generations. In our shul, there have been great rabbis davening in the shul, and none of them ever opened up their mouth to say that this person shouldn't be the shaliach tzibur. So I figured it must be permitted. I don't know. I imagine this gabbai said to Rabbi Hoffman, you know, you're the Talmid Chacham, you know the text. I just know the minhag. I just know that that the minhag of our shul has always been to allow somebody like this to daven. The efshar, and then Rabbi Hoffman starts, you know, like a good Talmudist, like a good halachist, saying, well, there must be a reason that they do it. So let's try to figure out why, after all the sources that we had at the top that said that it was forbidden, what could be the argument behind this? Efshar shesamchu al zeh ma shekatuv gam kein b'shut binyan tzion ha'chadashot siman kaf gimel, shemechalei shabbat v'zmaninu nechshavim k'tzat ketzinok shenishba levein hanochrim. That it's like a child that was, this is a common argument that you can't really blame the people who don't observe halakha these days, because they were, many of them were brought up in a situation where, in a society where there wasn't an atmosphere of shmirat mitzvot, and so that it's as if a child was kidnapped from his Jewish parents and brought up by non-Jews. You wouldn't blame somebody like this for not observing Torah. And so the same thing can be said of most of the people who are alive today. Maybe that was Mifnei Shabbatonotenu Rabim Rov Yisrael Be'aretzenu Mechalalei Shabbatim Ve'en Da'atam Bazeh Lichpor Be'inyanei Emunatenu. And, you know, because the community as a whole is not a frum community. And so they're not, they don't feel like they are being traitors to the Jewish people by not observing Jewish rituals, because they look around and most of the Jews around here aren't observing Jewish rituals. So maybe that changes the situation when you find somebody like this who isn't observant. V'chein higidli harav moreno harav meshulam zalman hakohen zal b'shem hagaon ba'al shoel umeshiv shekatav she'anashim me'amerika einam nifsalim al yedei chilul shabbat shalahem. Anybody from America certainly can't be blamed for being mechalel shabbat. You know, someone who comes from that atmosphere, we just won't blame them if they don't observe Shabbat. Mipnei shehem ketinok shenishba levein anochrim. That anybody who grew up in America. Yes, Rabbi, turn. I'm sorry? Himself is a German rep. Yes. Right, that's right. Yes. So, number eight. Yeah, ech sheyeh. Whatever the reason is, hamekel letzareif anashim ka'ilu leminyan yeshlo al mi sheyismoch. One can find grounds for leniency to allow somebody who isn't observant to be counted in a minyan. And then, surprisingly, again, I think this is giving us a window into the values of Rabbi Hoffman. Ach mi sheyachol leilech lebed akneset acher b'li lahachlim ish. Pshita demiyotov shelo yismoch al heter ze v'yitpalel im anashim sherim. But it would be better to go to a shul where everybody is Shomer Shabbos. And so, you know, this is somebody who, as we'll hear in a minute, had an extremely wide university education. And he still has, you know, some of the trappings of the Haredi type of person who would be most happy to be davening in a shul where everybody is Shomer Shabbat and not relying on a leniency like this. But then, as one last thought on the subject, you see how well he understands the world in which he is living at the end of the 19th and the beginning of the 20th century. Od yesh snif lahakel. Debizmanenu lo mikrei mechalel Shabbat befarhesia kevan sheruban osim kein. In the halachic literature, there's a category called the mechalel Shabbat befarhesia, the person who desecrates Shabbat in public. And, you know, if your store is open on Shabbat, or if you're walking through the streets and you are smoking on Shabbat, then you are desecrating Shabbat in public. But you see from the halachic literature that there's a difference between desecrating Shabbat in public and desecrating Shabbat in private. Why is there a difference between these two? So Rabbi Hoffman says the difference between desecrating Shabbat publicly and privately is that if it's based on the assumption that the Jewish public is observing Shabbat and I am breaking away from the Jewish public by desecrating Shabbat. Does that apply in our days? Asks Rabbi Hoffman. De bishlamayim rov Yisrael zakainu ma'atim me'izim pneihem lasod yisur ze hareyu kekofer batorav oseh toeva biyagrama uforesh atmo michlal Yisrael. In a time when everybody's observing Shabbat and the Jewish people, and there are a couple of individuals who don't observe Shabbat and go out in public and publicly demonstrate that they are breaking away from the Jewish people, That's a real chutzpah. One of my Rosh Yeshiva at Merkaz HaRav was once asked if he thought that the concept of the Mechalel Shabbat Befar Hesya exists today. And there's this question about touching wine and things like this. And he said that he thinks that if there's a Jew who, the chief rabbi of Israel would walk into the room where this Jew was, and the Jew knew that the chief rabbi of Israel was in the room, and he took a cigarette out of his pocket and he lit it in front of the chief rabbi of Israel. He said, that person might have the definition of a Mechalel Shabbat Befar Hesya. Somebody who realizes that, you know, he's in a situation where Shmirat Shabbat is to be expected, But on the streets of Jerusalem, there's no expectation that that you're going against the values of the city in some neighborhoods of Jerusalem. If you desecrate Shabbat. So that was, I should say it in his name, Rabbi Shaul Yisraeli said that to us when we were studying in Merkaz HaRav. I'm sorry?
The Rav said the same thing.
Uh-huh. That shows that you're not Mechalel Shabbat Befar Hesya. When you drive the car straight up to the door of the shul, then you are, in a certain sense, Mechalel. Yes. Right? Right. That shows that you don't want to be offending against the values of the community. Yes. Yes. Very good. That's a good line. Aval Kevan, so that it's, three lines from the bottom of this page. Aval kevan de'avonoteinu rabim rubam porzim hagader takanatam kalkalatam. The fact that most Jews don't observe mitzvot right now, actually, this problem becomes the solution. This bad thing becomes a takana. It helps us. Hayachid choshev she'in za'avera gdola kol kach ve'in tzarich la'asot betzina. Why do people these days desecrate Shabbat in public? Because there's so many of them, and they don't think that they're doing something terrible by desecrating Shabbat in public. They think to themselves, I know that it's the public, but it's as if I'm in private, because I'm not among a group of people who are committed to Shmirat Mitzvot. And a great line here at the end, V'adarabba hagireim kruim bizmanenu prushim umuvdalim. Who is poresh min hatzibur? Who separates themselves from the community? From people separate themselves from the community. They have gone against the values of Klal Yisrael, the values of the Jewish people. The Jewish people don't observe Shabbat, and those of us who do observe Shabbat are kind of sticking it to the majority and saying, we are not going to accept your definition of what it means to be Jewish. V'adar ha'yirevim kuruim b'zmanein ha'poshim u'mubdalim v'aposhim heim ha'ochim b'derach kol ha'aretz. The ones who desecrate Shabbat are doing what most of the Jews are doing. And so, and we are the ones who are separating ourselves from the community. So this is someone who really understands the changes that have taken place in the Jewish people. He wants to be observing the halakha the correct way. He feels that that would be ideal. He's committed to halakha, but he understands the social and historical changes. Yes. Don't embarrass anyone. Very good. Yes. It's really important to do it in such a way that you're not embarrassing anyone. Yes.
On the same subject, when he says you can go to another shul, I wonder what he means, what other shul. Is this in a situation where the competing are minyan with people who are Mechalel Shabbat, or just there are people in the shul who are Mechalel Shabbat? It's not...
Yes, it's not made 100% clear. That's right. That's right. Yes, yes. I wonder. You know, some of these discussions still go on today in 2015 about whether it's best to be in a shul where you share the values with everyone there, or is it best to be in a shul where people who are not as committed as I might be feel very comfortable coming, and the open shul where everyone feels comfortable being there. This debate still goes on today. Rabbi Hoffman is addressing it from the halachic literature, but he also is aware of the societal changes that have gone on. Okay. Rabbi Hoffman had a very wide secular education. He studied philosophy, history, and Semitic languages at the University of Vienna, at the Friedrich Wilhelm University in Berlin, and at the University of Tübingen, and he received a doctorate for academic Talmud studies at the University of Tübingen. Rabbi Hoffman was I think one of the first rabbis, maybe the first Talmid Chacham, who was involved in what I would call Talmud criticism, of looking and trying, you know, looking through the Mishnah and dividing up the Mishnah and saying that the Mishnah has a section that we will call the Mishnah Rishonah, like the first layer of the Mishnah, and then there are added layers of it, and looking through various works and saying, well, some of them come from this school, and the others come from another school, and when we understand the difference between the school of Rabbi Ishmael and the school of Rabbi Akiva, we can understand many of the disputes going on in rabbinic literature. This is something still somewhat controversial. I just remember a conversation that I had with an academic that I know, who I won't name, who's a very sincerely frum person, and he's not in Jewish studies. And he asked me one day, so what does it mean? He said, I study Gemara. What does it mean to study Gemara academically? Good, I'll explain. I started with the first point. I said, you know, there are different manuscripts, and you could check the manuscripts and try to determine what the most accurate text of the Talmud is. And this world-famous academic said to me, who cares? I just said, okay, I'll stop with the explanation at this point. There is a feeling that subjecting a work like the Talmud to critical analysis of this nature is going against Jewish values. Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch was not pleased with the Talmud criticism that Rabbi Hoffman did. I have a little joke to tell here, and they always say that if you have to explain a joke, you shouldn't bother telling it, but I do have to explain this joke, but I'll explain it first, and then I'll tell the joke. So the joke is based on a Gemara that I'm sure a lot of people here in this room know, but not everybody knows it. So first of all, I'll tell you about the Gemara in Chulin. The Gemara in Chulin says, "Kol the asar lan rachmana shara lan kabate." The Gemara is saying that a Jew should not feel deprived. It's true that the Torah forbids various things for us, but everything that was forbidden, there's something like it that you're allowed to do. And so if you have a taiva, you've got this strong desire to do this bad thing, you can channel it to something permitted and you'll be able to fulfill that desire. For example, the Gemara says, Asar lan dama, Shara lan kavda. We're not allowed to eat blood, but we are allowed to eat the liver, and the liver's got a lot of blood in it. And so, if you want the, if you're really dying to have blood, then make yourself some liver for dinner, and you'll get the taste of. The Gemara says that if you're dying to have basar b'chalav, then eat the udder of the animal, because the udder of the animal is meat that's got milk in it, and you'll get kind of the taste of it. There's even the line there that says that if you're a male and you've got this strong desire to be sleeping with somebody else's wife, then what you should do is marry a divorcee while her husband is still alive and walking around on the street, so you'll have the feeling as if you're sleeping with somebody else's wife. And it's permitted. You haven't broken any laws by doing that. Okay, so that's the background. That's what the Gemara says. So the story is told about two frum professors in Israel. One of them was in Talmud studies, and the other one wasn't in Talmud studies. And the one in Talmud studies was giving a lecture, and the one who wasn't in Talmud studies was there. And in the lecture, he tore apart a Talmudic passage and said, this whole section here is added by the Sevoraim, added after the days of the Amoraim. It's not part of the text. And this is a scribal error. And the whole text was torn apart. At the end of the lecture, the one who wasn't the Talmud scholar said, Kol the asar lan rachmana shara lan kavate. Everything that God forbade to us, He gave us something like it that is permitted. Asar lan bikorat hamikra, Sharalan bikoret sifrut chazal. God said it's forbidden to do biblical criticism, but he permits us to do Talmud criticism. This is a very sharp joke, which is really saying that it's the same methodology that is being used, you know, looking at a text and saying, there's a contradiction in this text. This doesn't look like it's similar to that. And the style of the text seems to have changed from this part of the text to that part of the text. So why don't we say that there are two different authors here and that an editor came along and put them together? So it's a simpler strategy for a frum Jew to simply say this kind of critical methodology is always wrong and should never be used for the analysis of any text, but to say this kind of methodology works just fine when you're studying Talmudic literature, but it should not be used when you're studying the Bible, is a much more difficult position to sustain. But Rabbi Hoffman, he was a very smart person. He understood this, and we'll talk about the way in which he tries to disprove biblical criticism. Very interesting. Asarlan Bikor Tami Krash, Aralan Bikor Sifrut Chazal. You're saying that was Halivni's. Could be. I'll be in Israel in a few weeks. I always see him in the National Library in the Judaica reading room. I'll ask him whether that was his motivation. Rabbi Hoffman wrote a Torah commentary that many people think very highly of. I think I might surprise people here today when I chose. Rabbi Kelman told me I could speak about anybody, and I chose to speak about Rabbi David Zvi Hoffman. I might surprise a number of you by saying, it's not my favorite Bible commentary. And when I'm stuck trying to figure out the meaning of a biblical verse and I want to see good commentaries on it, it's not at the top of the list of commentaries that I look at. And I'll try to explain why, but I'll also tell you its positive points. He had excellent language training and great sensitivity to the proper meaning of words, which is something that's extremely important to me. I think he made a wonderful step forward in Bible commentaries by separating the commentary from being always connected to a word or a phrase or at most a verse, because in the history of Jewish Bible commentaries, with very few exceptions, Jews usually write Bible commentaries that are based on the word, the phrase, or sometimes the verse. And he wrote about sections. He looked at the forest and not just at the individual trees, and that is a wonderful thing. I think the difficulty that I have, I'm just speaking about my own prejudices, but the difficulty that I have with Rabbi Hoffman's Torah commentary, last year when I spoke about Shadal, I talked about various types of approaches that people can have for solving the gap that we sense that exists between Pshat and Drash, between the plain, simple meaning of the text and what we find in rabbinic literature about the text. And I would generally say that there are four bigadol. In general, there are four ways of dealing religious Jews have dealt with this kind of issue over the years. One of them is the approach that says that, just like to give an example, you know, that when you first learn that the reason that we don't eat meat and milk on the same plate or within hours of each other is because of the verse that says, "Lo tabashel gadi b'chalev ibo," don't boil a kid in its mother's milk. Everybody says, "Huh? What's the connection between the meaning of the words and the rabbinic understanding of it. So approach number one says Midrash is actually deep pshat, that if you really, really look carefully at the text and you really attach significance to everything that's there in the text, you will see, you will eventually come to the Midrashic understanding of the text. The second system of interpretation, I would say that Malbim is a very good example of that, for those of you who have studied his Bible commentary. The second approach says that Midrash is a parallel system of interpretation, that the Torah was given to us, and there are two kinds of ways of reading the Torah. You can read it with Pshat methodology, and you can read it with Midrashic methodology. Both of them are important. The Midrashic one is probably more important. That's what Rashbam says. He says, I'm going to read it with the Pshat methodology. But there's also a way of reading it with the Midrash methodology. That was done in the Gemara. We're going to base our life as Jews on the Midrashic methodology. These are parallel to each other. They don't come to the same conclusion as each other. The third approach, Ibn Ezra's kind of approach, is to say that Midrash is not based on exegesis. It's not based on commentary on the text. It's based on traditions that were passed down orally and that were artificially attached later to the text. But if you're actually commenting on the text, if you're actually interpreting the text, you would never come up with a Midrashic understanding. And the fourth method that I talked about last year, that the extremely radical methodology proposed by Shmuel David Luzzatto, by Shadal in Italy, half a century before Hoffman, is that Midrash isn't exegesis, it isn't commentary, it's legislation. And that the rabbis are legislators as opposed to interpreters or people who are collecting traditions. As I read through Hoffman's commentary, I have difficulty placing him precisely in this situation, but I'd say that he's closest to the first approach of trying to prove that Midrash is actually deep shot. And if you look carefully at the text, you will understand how the rabbis came to the conclusions that they came to. He does it, I think, a lot better than Malbim does it, but I think that it's a very difficult thing to try to prove. In one place in his commentary, a very difficult verse, phrase like this appears four times in the Torah. Hanogea b'mizbeach yikdash. Kol hanogea b'mizbeach yikdash. Anyone who touches the mizbeach, the altar, yikdash. What in the world could that mean? So, Hoffman collects everything that the critics had written on the subject, and then he quotes Rashbam's commentary on the subject, and then he says about Rashbam's interpretation, he says, Hu hayoter na'ot mikol ha-perushim ha-midnagdim la-mesoret ha-chameinu zichronam livracha. Rashbam came up with the best interpretation that goes against Jewish tradition. And then he explains why he likes the traditional Jewish understanding of this text. Again, I think that I see a little bit of his sense of humor here. He's giving a compliment to this great Rishon, this great rabbi, this great Tosafist. He's saying, of all the interpretations that go against what the rabbi said, he actually came up with the best of them. But now I'll tell you why the rabbis are actually right in their understanding of this text. And I think that sometimes you have to stand on your head in order to try to accomplish the goal that he was trying to accomplish. But what I'm most interested in this evening, and whenever I read Hoffman, is what he does with biblical criticism. And we almost lost a lot of what Hoffman did with biblical criticism. He did write a book that we will talk about in a minute. We do have the commentary that he himself put together on the book of Vayikra, the book of Leviticus, in which there are many references to biblical criticism. But he also left notes behind about the rest of the Torah, and the editor who, after his death, put together the commentary on Bereshit, writes in the introduction here, a really telling comment here. Harbei nilchatsi ba'asher lepumuso shel ha'mechaber mevakrei ha'mikra. This isn't on the handout in front of you. Whenever Hoffman argues with the biblical critics, harbei nilchatsi lahashmito kalil. I came under a lot of pressure to leave this out of the book, to just publish the commentary without any reference to biblical critics. Mishum shelomdei haTorah shlomei emunei Yisrael einam mitanyanim b'chagonda, because good from Jews shouldn't be interested in a question like this at all. V'af ro'im b'yisuk b'ze mishum pgam. And you know, and the fact that somebody dealt with this, there's something wrong with the fact that they dealt with this. But he said, I think that that's wrong to do that. But what I will do to make people happy, I take out any reference to biblical critics from the text of the commentary, and I'm going to put it into the footnotes so that any from person who wants to read the commentary and doesn't want to get dirty by touching the critics that are mentioned there can read just on the top of the line and won't have to read on the bottom of the line. And anyways, you should all know that whenever Rabbi Hoffman wrote about something like this, he says, Hare ze ledidam bilvad, velo ledido, velo ledidan. He wasn't talking for himself. He wasn't talking for us. He was just saying, you know, those critics, they're wrong. He was talking to them, but he wasn't talking to himself. So I don't really agree with the editor of the Bereshit volume, and I'm glad that he left in the references to the criticism, and although I have heard people saying who have seen the original notes, that he did take things out anyways, and that he did not preserve all of the sections that dealt with criticism. If you skip to page 2 in the handout, you see a section from my book that Hoffman himself wrote called Die wichtigsten Instanzen gegen die Graf Wellhausensche Hypothese. The best proofs, the strongest proofs against the hypothesis of Graf Wellhausen, the hypothesis of biblical criticism. I'm not going to assume that everybody here knows what biblical criticism is, so I will just say a few words about biblical criticism. The most popular version of biblical criticism suggests that there are four major documents that from which the Torah was put together, and one of them will be called J, one of them E, one of them P, and one of them D, and they were put together by a person named R. The oldest of these documents might go back to like the 9th century, a little bit after the time of King David, although probably most of the people who talk about the documentary hypothesis wonder whether King David actually ever existed historically. But the time when people think that King David lived is the oldest documents, and generally the understanding is that the latest of the documents was the document called P, which would be dated to the 5th or 6th century, sometime after Churban HaBayit, after the destruction of the temple, after the Jews had been in Babylonia. They came back to Eretz Yisrael and brought P with them, or wrote P after they came back to Eretz Yisrael. This hypothesis is often attributed to Julius Wellhausen, who was just a few years younger than Hoffman, just died a few years before before Hoffman died, and was still writing when Hoffman was writing against his hypothesis. The theories go back quite a bit before. They go back already to the late 18th century. Jean Astruc might have been the first person to suggest this possible way of understanding the composition of the Torah. Just before Hoffman wrote this book, biblical criticism had taken an interesting turn in suggesting that the document called P probably consists of two documents that were put together. P stands for the priestly code, and P is the kind of author, according to the biblical critics, who's interested in ritual, interested in sacrifices, and interested in lists, knowing who begat whom, long lists of who begat whom, that's usually P, who's into things like that. And talking about how many years somebody lived, that's usually P. And talking about the korbanot, the sacrifices in the beginning of Vayikra, that's always attributed to P. But then people started to notice that there are sections of Vayikra, there are sections of Leviticus that seem to have like ritual mixed with morality. And that didn't fit in all that well with the theory of the biblical critics that P wasn't interested in that kind of stuff. And so the theory developed that P was actually put together from two sources, an old source called H, that stands for the holiness code, that is mostly Parshat Kedoshim, but a few other sections like this, where there is quite a bit of consideration of moral and ethical issues, which was combined together with something that was like the source of that was the source of P, and made into this new source. This theory is still accepted by most biblical critics who are alive today. Most biblical critics who are alive today will talk about H being a separate document from P. And much of Hoffman's book is against this hypothesis. So let's just read through a little bit of this hypothesis. Page 2 of the handout. אנחנו כבר כתבנו לאל שספר תורת כהנים כולל בתוכו לפי דברי בית מדרשה של הביקורת החדשה עוד ספר חוקים שקדם לו במקצת. We already told you that the critics say that Leviticus, that's normally called P, includes within it an older document that they call H. הנקרא בפי המבקרים ספר הקדושה. They call this the Heiligkeit Gesetz, the Sefer HaKadusha, the Holiness Code. Shechalakav ha'ikarim nivtza'im b'vayikra yudzayin kafav. Most of it can be found in chapter 17 through 26 of Vayikra. And then he has an extremely learned footnote here at the bottom of the page where he goes through all of the critics and talks about how they assign sections to H or don't assign sections to H. And you see that there's quite a bit of variety. There isn't like everybody said, oh, there's H, and we know immediately what goes into H. And no, it doesn't work that way. There are all sorts of arguments about what really would go in H. אופייה המיוחד של תורת הקדושה הזאת לפי דילמן ואחרים הוא שהצפייה להיות קדושים הכתובה בספר בספר הברית, ביחד עם תביעות ודרישות רבות אחרות, נעשתה כאן להשקפה מנהלת ומורה דרך. The mitzvah of being holy lies at the center of things for the author of H. שהעמידה גם את דיני התאומה והתארה וגם את חוקי הקורבנות והמתנות ביחס של זיקה אליה. And the author of H thinks that everything is connected with being holy. רק על ידי הפרשת תורת הקדושה מהמקור כביכול של תורת כהנים עלה בידי בית המדרש המודרני לתאר דופיו ומהותו של Q, המקור היסודי של תבר כהנים, באופן רצוי ונוח לקיומה ולעמידתה של כל ההיפותזה. This was an important thing for biblical criticism to do because separating H out from the rest of Vayikra allows them to say that after the Jews returned from the Babylonian exile, they were just into rituals and they didn't care about morality or ethics or things like this. All they were interested in were sacrifices and lists and, you know, it was people, authors almost on the autism spectrum, just, you know, all these little details of the sacrifices, but the talks about holiness and things like that, that must be something else. In order to claim that a document like this exists, then after talking for a long time about the existence of one document called P, they say, oh, we have to split this up into two sections so that we can say that there is one of the, that there is this kind of primitive ritualistic document here. Kol ha-tzavim ha-rabim, I'm at A here on page 3, Kol ha-tzavim ha-rabim b'inyanei musar midot u-mishpatim ha-ktuvim b'vayikra, yud-zayin ad-kafe, enam matimim lahanachoteim ha-mukdamot shel ha-mevakrim ha-omrim she-sefer Torah Kohanim, hu rak kovetz, shel chukei kehuna ve-kultus bilvad. They want to be able to say that P essentially is a document that only talks about priests and about cult, and they're not interested in anything else. Holzinger, another one of the critics, Mukrach Lohodot Ki PH, the document that we call H now, Hu Bakocha Hashalem Shel Ruach HaMusarit VaHumanit HaShoreret BeSefer HaBrit VaMishneh HaTorah. So Holzinger says, well, you know, actually, when you look at H, it's not all that different from the other sections before that. It does have that humanitarian kind of aspect to it. יש בו קורבה בלתי אמצעית לחוקי המוסר של המקורות האי ומשנה תורה, כל פרק יוצאת בייחוד, מתרומם לגופם של חוקי המוסר שנאמרו במקומות אחרים, especially chapter 19, the beginning of Parshat Kedoshim, Kedoshim תהיו כי קדוש אני השם אלוקיכם. No one can fault that as an ethical text, as one of the highest level ethical texts around. V'yesh v'nireh lanu shuchikei ha-musar asher b'torat ha-kedushah higiu gam l'madreika d'itpatchut v'ishtalmut gvoha yoter. In fact, we might even say that the laws that are there might even be at a higher moral level than the laws that you find in other books. And he gives an example. This is still this critic saying this and saying, you know, actually arguing that it's hard to argue that P is this primitive. It is. It's okay. We can say that if once we take out H. And he gives the example that in the in Shmot it says, V'dal lo te'adar berivo, don't show favoritism to a poor person when a legal case comes before you in court. And in Parshat Kedoshim it says, lo tisa p'nei dal v'lo te'adar p'nei gadol. Don't show favoritism to anybody because they're poor, and don't show favoritism to anybody because they're rich. And so, can't say that there's a lower level of morality in this book. And in the continuation, I won't read through everything here. He says, well, you know, we can also talk about v'ahavta l'reacha kamocha, showing up there was this considered like the pinnacle of morality. So if we go on to the let's skip to the next page 4 here. Hasibah ha'ikarit shegarma likriat sefer hakdusha me'amakor ha'yisodi shel Torat Kohanim. The major reason why critics were able to justify separating out H from P. He, sheyesh bo bituyim v'ofnei dibur she'enam nimtzaim kivyachol beprisle shegrundschrift PG. They argued, they based their proof that there are two different documents on the fact that there are different phrases that appear in these different documents, different uses of language. Hoffman writes, Amarti kivyachol, I said, as if there were differences. Mipnei sha'aliba de'emet, because if you look carefully, nimtza'im rova bituyim biktza'im sheyichusam kodem b'li shum sveikot lamakor hayisodi. If you look at their arguments don't work. Aval ata mikevan sheratzu yoter lamabakrim likroa et sefer hakdusha mitorat hakohanim nimnu vegamru lisok halacha sherubam shelaktaim asher b'makor hayisodi heim chelkei sefer hakdusha olbdu al yedei mesader v'orech shechai b'tkufa mu'ucheret. So whenever they see a problematic verse, they move it to a different source. But I want to bring some of their examples. אני רוצה להביא כאן דוגמאות אחדות. המילים אני השם או אני השם אלוקיכם הולכות וחוזרות תדיר נחשבות לאחד הסימנים המובהקים של ספר הקדושה. The critics argue that anybody who's a Torah reader knows that if you're reading Parshat Kedoshim, it keeps saying אני השם אלוקיכם, and that would say, okay, this is a sign of H, according to the critics. But let me give you all these examples of other places in the Torah where the phrase exists. And he gives quite a number of examples. Hanuscha Hashniyah, their second example, Ish, Ish. That's again supposed to be a linguistic sign of the document H. Nimtzeit gam bevayikra tedvav bet bevayimidbar. So in all sorts of texts that they don't assign to H. So you can't say that this is a sign of H. Hanuscha Hashlishit, Nose Avon, Onose Chit. This is the third proof that they bring. It's also in a whole bunch of other documents, but they haven't proved anything. Bituim Achadim Heim, this is the B here, Bituim Achadim Heim, O Hapax Lagamina. Either they find a word that appears once in the Torah and they say, oh, this is a sign of H. Well, it appeared once in the Torah, so how can you say that it's a sign of anything? It's just there once. O shehem nimtzaim gam b'sefer hakdusha rak b'perek echad o b'mekomot ma'atim kol kachat she'i efshar l'tzayin otam b'tor simanim ofiyim shel eza sefer. They appear so rarely. They appear once there. They appear so rarely. L'mashal damav bo o demehem ba nimtza rak b'vayikra perekach. So there's a chapter that keeps using this phrase. Can that be? But it only uses it in that one chapter. Can you say that that's a sign of this? And right at the bottom, skipping to the bottom here, ha'hevdilim ha'lashoniyim v'ha'inyaniyim sh'bein sefer ha'kdusha l'vein yeter chalkei torat kohanim mitbarim al nekala al yedei zeh she'tochnam shel ha'sfarim hanal shone ish me're'ehu. Why is there different language? Because when you're talking about different kinds of things, you use different words. And in the footnote, he gives an excellent example. Limashal, the bottom line on the page in the footnote, et aperek hamadaber al hakamat hamishkan, if you compare that to other sections of Vayikra, the critics say that the sections about the Mishkan, about the tabernacle at the end of the book of Shmot, are from the same source as as the korbanot, as the sacrifices in the beginning of Vayikra, the same that's from the same author. They're all from P. But when you look at it, the language is very different because one of them is talking about animal sacrifices and one of them is talking about a construction project. And so when you find different phrases, the simplest explanation is to say, well, it's talking about different things and that's why they're using different phrases. This is the kind of argumentation that Rabbi Hoffman uses to try to disprove the documentary hypothesis. What I think is one of the great things about this this way that he did it, you know, on the rare occasion these days when you hear a religious thinker speaking out against against the documentary hypothesis and not just ignoring the documentary hypothesis. What we usually hear today is that the critics hate the Torah or hate Judaism, or we hear that the critics don't have Yirat Shamayim, and that the way to interpret the Torah correctly is having Yirat Shamayim. Now, I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with those kinds of approaches, but they're not the strongest way of dealing with the claims of biblical criticism. What Rabbi Hoffman tried to do was to take the methodology of biblical criticism, assert that the methodology could, in theory, work. And, you know, and he's using that same kind of methodology, as I said before, to do Talmudic criticism, and say that the Bible critics are doing a poor job of doing it. And that if you look at their methodology, the arguments, you know, this book, the Best Proofs Against Wellhausen, isn't a book that's trying to say that the best proofs are because we know that the Kodesh Baruch Hu gave the Torah to us and he gave the Torah Shabbal Pet. You know, that's not, he doesn't feel that that's the best proof against Wellhausen. The best proof against Wellhausen is reading the Torah carefully, using this methodology and using Seichel, and showing that this methodology just does not work. And I think that he sincerely believed that that was the case. He was a sincerely believing Jew, and he sincerely believed that he could prove that the methodology of the biblical critics doesn't work. Any questions to this point? Yes. No, it was written in German. And an excellent English translation of this text was prepared by someone in this room, Dr. Carla Schulzbach over here, but I didn't have it, and so I gave you the...
If anybody wants it, I can email it.
Yes. Yes. Just a few days ago, I told Carla I was looking on the web, and I said I knew that it was there, and you know, I was trying to see where might it just be available on the web for free? And okay, couldn't find it. Pardon me. Yes. You see, that is, I think that the Frumis who didn't want the publisher of Breishit to be publishing this might have been thinking in that same way, that when you make arguments like this, you are kind of admitting that if it actually worked well, then maybe I would believe it. Now, I'm not sure that that would apply to Rabbi Hoffman himself, but methodologically, you're absolutely right, David. That is the conclusion that you might come to, and that could be the reason that a lot of people avoided doing this. Yes. Well, we just looked at one little piece here, but when you look at all of his commentaries together, the amazing thing is that he read all of this stuff that he knew biblical criticism called, and that he taught about it in his rabbinical seminary. You know, his commentaries were based on the shiurim that he taught to his yeshiva boys, to the rabbis that were being trained. They were all learning biblical criticism, And they were all learning with him what was wrong with biblical criticism. And he, you know, about the about issues like the documents, he never yielded an inch. And so he said that when you put together all of the my proofs against their proofs, there's nothing left of this construction. But maybe let's look at one last example here on the fifth page here of the handout. Here's a here's a photocopy from his commentary, which he did not edit himself, on the 14th chapter of Bereishit. The 14th chapter of Bereishit is that really unusual chapter about the war between the four kings and the five kings. And you're sitting there and you're reading it, and you're seeing this king and that king, and you're wondering, what does this have to do with the story of my people, of the Jewish people? And you get 15, 20 verses into the story before you hear the mention of Avram, of our forefather Avram, because somebody came and told Avram that his nephew had been taken captive in this war. And then Avram gets involved. So, as I told you before, the editor here who wanted people to be able to read this without encountering the critics put all the criticism into the footnote. So let's start with the footnote here, this long footnote on page Resh Kaftalva on the right-hand side. Lo yipale efo. It shouldn't surprise anybody. Shaloma atim mina mevakrim achadashim, that many of the modern critics marim inyan miyuchad beperek zeh. They had particular interest in this chapter, in chapter 14 of Bereishit. Shebo matzu kachei ma'aminim et haketa hayachid shedan betoldot yemei kedem. They say, here we found some ancient history, a war of four kings against five kings. No Jews involved in that, no Israelites involved, but four non-Jewish kings and five non-Jewish kings going to war. But we've got a piece of history here. Yuvald Kotev, Velo notar lano efo. I thought that this translation of the German of Yuvald into Hebrew was so difficult to understand. I stared at it for a long time, and then I went and I apologized. My German isn't all that it should be. It exists, but it's not very good. But I found an old English translation of Yuvald's commentary, and here's what he said in the English translation. There thus remains nothing for us but to rejoice in the rare good fortune which has preserved to us this single instructive fragment. For he who, after a careful study of it, could still doubt the reality of the lives of Abraham and Lot, this can scarcely be even beginning to see anything with certainty in the field of history. Anybody who can read this and not conclude that Abraham and Lot were real historical characters, well, they don't know anything about historical, about how to do history. Because this isn't a text that was really about Abraham. That most of the text isn't about Abraham. Abraham just makes, like, this appearance at the end of the text. And so it's like we have this extra biblical source that's talking about the existence of Abraham and the existence of Lot, and then the biblical author brought this into the text. Ulam, okay,
credibility to it.
Pardon me?
By doing that,
yes.
The author gets credibility,
yes.
To Abraham.
That's right. Yeah, right. Ulam, however, line 7, Achirim, like Nuldike, Machishim Mehemuto, Shalketa Ze Cherefa Pratim Shanim Sarim Mbo. Another critic says, this text couldn't be historical at all. And why am I telling you this? Kamuvan She'en Lanu Shum Inyan Leikanes Bitchumam Shaleila. I'm not here to kind of solve the dispute between these two biblical critics. לא של השוללים ולא של המחייבים, אבל ענייננו הוא לקבוע עובדת חילוקי דעות אלה כדי להראות בהם שאין לחשוב כמין הבחינה המדעית, אין מקום לראות כעובדה היסטורית מוכחת, דבר שאנשי מדע מפוכחים רואים כאגדה בלבד. I'm just trying to show you how this science of biblical criticism works here, that some people say, obviously, this has to be historical truth. And some of the critics say, this couldn't be historical truth. Look at the text here. It's obvious that it's not describing a real historical event. So there you are about how reliable biblical criticism is. בכל מקרה מעין דא, in any case like this, נצביע על פרק זה, שמן הדיונים סביבו מתבהר, כי קטע אחר עשוי לעורר רושם שונה אצל החוקרים השונים שונים. Okay. 15. והנה לגבי פרקנו זה סובר יובלד, שהוא מבוסס על מקורות חוץ. So יובלד thinks that this text was imported into the Bible from somewhere else. למסקנה זו הוא מגיע בשל הכינוי העברי, שניתן לו לאברהם בו. And he comes to this conclusion because Avram is called, for the only time in Tanakh, he is called Avram HaIvri. Now, the Tanakh knows that we are the Hebrews, and the whole book is about the Hebrews. And so, why do you have to say that Avram is a Hebrew? Ah! It must be, because the text is a text from outside of Tanakh that was imported into the Tanakh. That's Uvald's argument. אחרים כגון דילמן רוצים לחזק דעה זו בטענה שאין כל הסבר אחר לכינוי זה. And Dillman says, another critic says, there couldn't be any other explanation for why Avram would be called an Ivri. שניתן לאברהם כאן וכאן בלבד שכן בשביל הקורא העברי אין בציון כינוי זה משום הענקת מהימנות יתר למסופר. There's no reason for it to be here. It doesn't make the story more believable or anything like that. לדעתה מצא העורך את שמו של אברהם העברי מוזכר בספר או בכתבה שדן במסע זה של מלכי המזרח, והדבר נראה לו די חשוב כדי להשתמש בו בתיאורו את חיי אברהם מבלי למחוק כינוי זה שאכן אין לו עוד כל חשיבות בקונטקסט החדש. So they say the biblical editor found this extra biblical document, thought, oh, I should preserve this extra biblical document, moved it into the Tanakh, and forgot to take out that word Ivri, because there's no necessity inside of the Tanakh to call Avram an Ivri. Ela shela mito shel davar sibat haskarat kinui zehi acheret lagamrei reila alam beferushen lefasuk. You give me said I've got good reasons. I can give you good arguments. I'm not going to present those arguments to you. You can look up his commentary, and there are fine explanations about why there would be a reason to say this in this passage. Okay, so we see him dealing with the critics. We see him showing the contradictions between the approaches of critics who are ostensibly using the same methodology. We see him dismissing this argument that this text must be imported from somewhere else. And then we decide, maybe let's look at his commentary on top of the line. And what do we see here? He says, until now the Torah was really Sipur Toldot Mishpacha Achat. You know, we've been dealing with one family until now. Asher Yesh Bo Mishum Chariga L'toch Tum Toldot HaAmim. We now have a text that's talking about the history of various other nations. V'yitachin Sheketa Zeh Mekoro B'Sefer Milchamot Hashem. Maybe this text, Genesis chapter 14, was originally part of a different book. A book that is described in the Torah called Sefer Milchamot Hashem. So, you know, what's he doing here? He's giving like a from version of the theory of the critics that this text was imported into the Torah. But he said it came from a nice kosher source called Sefer Milchamot Hashem Shekein. Malki Tzedek Mevarechet Hashem al Mesirat HaMelachim Bidei Avram. Hevei Omer She Milchama Azo Le Milchamot Hashem Hi Nechshevet. We can call this one of the wars of God because Malki Tzedek was involved there. Malki Tzedek is involved with the worship of God. Umi Mekorosh B'Sefer Shabo Merukazim Sipurei Milchamot Ele Hu Atak Af Tiura Shel Milchama Azo Le Torah Al Pi Hashem. And even though this was written in Sefer Milchamot Hashem, which is not a book that was written, we assume, with divine revelation, but the Kadosh Baruch Hu told Moshe to take that section from Sefer Milchamot Hashem and put it into the Torah. And, you know, when you think about it, you know, if you believe in the holiness of the Torah and in the historical accuracy of the Torah, you know, you have to realize that there are various lines in the Torah, like lines that Pharaoh said. So if you believe in the historical accuracy of the Torah, Pharaoh said the following words, like, you should live so long until I'll let you go with your children. So those words were actually composed by whom? They were composed by Pharaoh. He said them. Why are they in the Torah? Because, you know, Pharaoh said a lot of things in the time that he was alive. And the Kadosh Baruch Hu told Moshe to write some of those things down in the Torah. And some of them you don't write down in the Torah. Not everything that was in so the holiness of those words is because the Kadosh Baruch Hu told Moshe to write them down in the Torah. And then, so you can do the same thing and say here, here's a section that was written in another old Jewish book that was called a kosher Jewish book that wasn't a revealed Jewish book that was called Sefer Milchamot Hashem. And the Kadosh Baruch Hu told Moshe, take that section and put it in the Torah. And because this whole question of how it was in the generation before Abarbanel, I forget, I'm sorry, the Professor Lowy made Aliyah, and I can't ask him this question, but it was one of the Abarbanel's teachers who was the first to pose the question, hey, wait a second, the whole book of Devarim is a speech given by Moshe. So is it of a lower level of holiness than the other sections of the Torah, because the words were composed by Moshe? And after this question was asked for the first time in the 15th century, there were a number of people who dealt with the question. The general answer was no, and that although Moshe gave a speech, the reason why the speech is in the Torah is because God said that the speech should be in the Torah. So the words could have been composed by God, by Moshe, but their status was enhanced by God deciding that these parts should be included in the Torah. So Hoffman is doing that. And if you just look, without looking at details, if you just look at the next page and look at the footnotes, he's quoting various critics. When the critics say something, there's a proof from Uvald in footnote 6 and from another critic in footnote 7 and then in footnote 10 and then in number 12 there's a reference to some Assyrian text, and he will use these his knowledge of the ancient Near East, and he will use the theories and the writings of the critics when he doesn't feel that they are going against Jewish values and when he feels that they are reasonable. And so we have an extremely interesting and creative and, I would say, very brave person who studied everything that biblical criticism had to say, did not reject everything. He did reject the documentary hypothesis, and he felt that it was still possible to believe in Torah Moshe Sinai and still learn various things from the critics. And I would say that one of the saddest things is that for the last 100 years, I don't know anybody else who has done this. Certainly no one of the stature of Rabbi David Zvi Hoffman has, the biblical criticism has changed a little bit since Rabbi Hoffman wrote this. And there's nobody doing this today. And it would be a great service to the Frum community if a Talmid Chacham of the level of Rabbi Hoffman were to do this. Yes, Carla. Right. Right. Yes, the opposite is taking place. Carla is definitely right of writing out the anything that might be considered to be not kosher, but even Rashbam's commentary. For those of you who didn't read it, you should look at Mark Shapiro's blog postings about what was done to Rashbam's commentary by Art School recently. Yes. Right.
But he clearly believes in science.
He believes in science. That's right.
Yeah, that's clear.
Yeah.
The other thing is that these days it would be much more difficult because of archaeology. I mean, he didn't have access to the archaeological knowledge that we now have. True that there are great debates about what that does for us. But I think one person who did attempt it is Halivni. Not in Talmud, in Bible. Halivni had
yes.
And that's his approach, I think, to contemporary biblical criticism.
Yes.
I think most critics see it as apologetic and sort of silly. But it's his honest attempt to deal with it.
It was an honest attempt, yes. Halivni actually did an honest attempt, but it didn't go to the particulars. It was in generalities. It was dealing with the generalities of the issue. And this is amazing. You know, he went through the entire Torah, through every pasuk in his classes, in his seminary, and talked about what the critics had to say about it and why they're wrong and why we're right, and incorporating a little bit of them along the way that he thought could be incorporated into a Jewish understanding of the text. That's an amazing life work for somebody who was spending most of his time learning Gemara and things like that. Yes, yes, Ruthie. The Jewish Publication Society is, you mean the commentary on the Torah? You know, it's one of my favorite commentaries on the Torah, and it's criticism light or criticism gentle or something like that. And it's trying not to be heavy-handed in the way that many critics were heavy-handed. But, you know, if you read some of the notes there carefully, they are suggesting that, you know, this may come from a different story. This and this can't be reconciled with each other. And, you know, they're not trying to defend. Hoffman is trying to defend the traditional Jewish understanding of the Torah. And I think he did a darn good job at the beginning of the 20th century. And it's a shame that no one has quite modernized this. Yes, Rabbi Kelman. Ah, yes.
That's really another lecture. I realize yes. that, but maybe 2 minutes if you can comment on that.
You know.
Thank you back for the Mordechai Breuer lecture.
Yes. One of Mordechai Breuer's students once told me that Rabbi Breuer said, "Abayayim bikorat hamikra." The problem with biblical criticism. He. She'im ma'aminim be'bikorat ha-mikra, as ata apikoros. That if you believe in Bible criticism, then you're a heretic. V'im lo ma'aminim be'bikorat ha-mikra, But if you don't believe in biblical criticism, then you're an ignoramus. And so Rabbi Breuer figured out a way to believe in Bikurat HaMikra without believing in Bikurat HaMikra. And I think, I'll just mention my shortcomings, I don't think that I'm sufficiently postmodern to be able to understand what Rabbi Breuer was really suggesting. And I think I can suggest some people who you might be able to bring here to talk about Rabbi Breuer, people like Professor Shimon Gesundheit from the Hebrew University in Jerusalem, who does this, who does, you know, criticism that is right in the tradition of Graf and Wellhausen, and sends his kids to places like Horev for their education, and says that he's a disciple of Rabbi Breuer, Vani lo mivin, and I don't quite understand how that works. Yes, Rabbi Turner.
Yeah, I also wanted to mention Breuer, but I think, without going into details, but his principle was that you need Bible criticism to really come to a true understanding of what it's all about.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, those kind of problems that are presented are good reasons to further your understanding of the thing.
Right. It's an interesting line. I recall I studied it some amount. I don't consider myself an expert in biblical criticism, but I studied some amount of biblical criticism. I remember one of my professors, I won't name him, once after he had been a professor of mine, he went off on a sabbatical, and he told me when he came back from his sabbatical, he said, you know, I spent my sabbatical year studying the traditions of Jewish parshanut. He was Jewish, but he had a weak background in the history of parshanut, and he had learned biblical criticism. He said, "Nobody asks better questions than those traditional Jewish commentators." And now, Rabbi Turin, you're saying the opposite. Like, we can learn. You know, my professor was saying, I don't really like the answers that they give, but it's great how they ask those questions, and it gets me to think about it. I think Breuer was saying something more than that. He wasn't just saying the critics ask really good questions, and I have different answers for them. I think he was saying something more than that, but I don't know because I don't quite understand where he went. Yes. Kasuto was a brilliant commentator on the Bible, and that's, you know, a commentary that I love opening up when I have a text that's troubling me. And he did write a book called The Documentary Hypothesis that tried to show the holes in the documentary hypothesis. Among the many languages that I don't know how to read is Italian, and I am told that in Kasuto's Italian writings, he makes it clear that he didn't quite buy into the traditional Jewish understanding of how the Torah was written. That he was an Orthodox rabbi, and he didn't think that it was a good idea for him to write that in Hebrew, in his Hebrew works. But he did write it in his Italian works because it seems like you could get away with just about anything in Italy during many centuries of Jewish history. And if I had it all to do over again, I think I would study Italian as an undergraduate and spend my time studying this Italian Jewish community, which was so interesting. So he did take it on a little bit, and he did show some of the holes in the documentary hypothesis. But he did not end up really defending the traditional position the way that Hoffman attempted to defend the traditional position. Yes, Rob.
Did any of Hoffman's students take after him? I don't know any of his students.
Yes. I don't know. Carla, do you know whether any of them followed in his... I'm sorry?
Mark
Shapiro. Yes. I guess we'll ask him. Yes. Fan. Yes.
just attacking the specific broad theories of the documentary sources, but rather examination of the subject matter, we'll say korbanot, or etymologies, which were an answer to perhaps the critics, but were really taking the, in a sense, traditional parshanut further.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be a disservice to typify the commentary as strictly as apologetics.
Right. Very good. He did attempt to do much more in the commentary, and this is a non-typical page of the commentary where you've got this much about the critics and only this much of commentary. Most of the time, most of the work wasn't about the critics. It was about the Torah, and as you say, Stan, correctly, it has that chidush in it, that it's looking at larger sections of the Torah and trying to explain its ideas.
Okay, thank you. Just since we're talking on that,